Welcome to Eyes and Teeth Season 8, featuring members of the Grand Order of Water Rats, the greatest show business charity and brotherhood in the world, where entertainers, comedians, speciality acts, producers, agents, actors, musicians and members of the royal family have joined together since 1889. And I wasn't there from the beginning. To listen to past episodes and fantastic stories of behind the scenes of show business with over 100 interviews since June 2020, all you have to do is download for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please review and award Eyes and Teeth a rating, which will help get it to more people. My goal is to savour the performers' memories and their careers in a vault for centuries, so these 50 to 100 years of anecdotes can be retold in whatever future the planet ends up with. Today, my brilliant guest joins me for a wonderful chat about his career, and he has worked with them all. I'm honoured to call him a friend, and during this time you will hear his genuine personality, his passion for his work and his colleagues, from Stanley Baxter to Mr. Blobby, from the famous TV series The Bill to Doctor Who, and playing Scrooge in the West End and decades of baddies in pantomime. This one you're going to enjoy. When I welcome to Eyes and Teeth, Graham Cole, OBE. One Kenobi. Yes, one of the jokes that I do.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for the full title. How kind.
We've got a lot of letters after our names, haven't we? And not many people do have letters.
Not necessarily transmittable.
And no, the ones my dad used after my name, I cannot repeat here. But yeah, it's so great to see you, Graham. And usually I do a lot of these on the phone, but it is nice to see a happy, smiley face now and again. And it's good to see what posters you have on the wall. Were you in that movie? Are you in that one?
No, alas.
It's one of my favourites.
One of my sons. This is my son's bedroom, if he's ever here.
He might be in bed now. So that's Hitchcock.
That's Hitchcock, that is, yeah. Rear Window. Great movie. Great movie. Okay. It's all set in a bedroom and a pair of binoculars, basically, and only Hitchcock would ever get away with it. It's beautiful.
Yes. Absolutely.
If you haven't seen it, because it's all psychological, you know, and he clicks it away in your head and you get yourself ahead of the storylines. That's what I loved about it.
Yes. Amazing. He's unique, isn't he? I heard an interview about Alfred Hitchcock. I think it was, it couldn't have been Desert Island Discs, or was it? And I mean, people were talking about him, you know. It's very interesting character. But me and Nina got into, because we've tried everything over lockdown and Netflix, but we watched this. That sounds rude. No, not everything. We didn't try everything. So
I've seen Nina. I can well understand that.
So television, movies and stuff. We watched this country and western film, this western, and she said, oh, let's watch more westerns. So I went and bought some Clint Eastwood films, and yeah, we're now watching, catching up on the Clint Eastwood classics, yeah, you know, Fistful of Dollars and all that.
Yeah, John Wayne and all those guys. Way before your time, they were my heroes when I used to go to Saturday morning cinema.
Is that where you started?
I was eight. And you're going to have to explain this to your listeners, what sixpence is. But
how much is it now?
You could get in 1.5p or something, isn't it? But you could get into a cinema as a kid and get a drink and a packet of popcorn and stuff and watch an AIM Clark movie film, and the B movies I love because they're all the old war films, you know, and in which we serve and stuff like that. I love that, but I loved it because they were blokes, they were men,
yeah, real men. You know,
it's interesting what you say about you and Nina, because Cherry and I, there's nothing on the telly. I'm terrible to say, this is my industry. Nothing on the television.
Well, the bill's finished. There's nothing on the telly now. Yeah.
Well, the thing I think the problem is that obviously they pre-recorded so early. But then this pandemic hit and we're all in this strange limbo state and we're losing mates right, left and centre, or you're hearing of family losses.
Yes.
And all that's on the television is death and destruction or shouting and stuff like that.
So it's nice to choose.
Where's Mark and Wise?
I know, when you need them. Yeah.
Laurel and Hardy. Where's, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's just none of that stuff. And I spent my youth around those people.
I know you did. And I'm really excited about talking about all this because you've connected there's so many of these people sort of on these TV shows. And this isn't the first time I've interviewed you. So you joined me on a show in Eastbourne on Arfalaga's Big Night In. And it was an idea. I have all these crazy ideas, Graham. But this I wanted to bring variety, live performances, game shows, interviews, a live band into the community of Eastbourne. And you're one of my favorite people. And I asked, and you, bless you, you've done it again. You came down. And we had a great time. And I interviewed you. Yeah. The interview was you with my highlight. We only ended up doing three of those shows because the venue closed down. And so hopefully we'll revamp it. But talking to you about your career, you're so full of anecdotes. And I could pick a subject, TV show or movie you'd been in. And you've got a story about any of that. But you do love talking about, you know, this business that we're in. It's a passion. It's not like you're working 9 till 5 and, you know, spilt a coffee over the computer. You've got great anecdotes, you know, about your career because it's about people, isn't it?
If you're lucky enough to do what you love, and there's not many of us really that get that opportunity.
Yes.
And I can remember being in the cinema watching those greats and looking at my peers and at the 8, 9, 10. And honestly, Steve, I wanted to create what they had created on that screen to those people around me, that you're all in one mind at one moment in time. Like you, I love live because you just do not know what the audience is going to do to you.
That's true. It's true.
I just love that. And that's why I love Panto, because, you know, they let you know. If you're no good at it, they'll let you know.
they do. Yes, if they're booing you, and if they're booing you and you're not the baddie, you know you're not doing too great.
But I'm only ever the baddie, mate, as you know.
You are. I know. You're one of the best baddies in the business.
That's music to my ears. But now you're right. You know, what do you watch on TV? You know, the light entertainment stuff, they're too scared.
Yes.
You know, I've worked with Little and Large, Cannon and Ball, and their first shows, you know, on big theatres for Del Fontegrade.
Amazing.
And you just know that they're not going to get anywhere because the producers wouldn't understand them to start with.
No.
Or the way you get into performance. You know, it's not action. It doesn't work like that. And of course, working with like Noel Edmonds, you know, and all that sort of stuff, you know, on the house party and meeting all these greats there and our sketches that we used to do. But it's all about timing. And it's all about knowing that all you are is an element in that.
Yes. And do you think it has to be a natural thing that you have? So you have that ability. You have timing. You know, you know your comedy as well. You're a great actor, but you're really good at comedy sketches. You're in so many comedy shows. I've been researching you. Graham's done this. I can't believe he's been in that. He must have been doing sketches. And obviously you do pantomimes. So you're prone to doing a great comedy scene with another actor or comedian. And you know your stuff, don't you?
I think what you have to roll back to again, of course, is that my bosses, Del Fontegrade, were acts themselves that went into management.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate with those guys. I was a chorus boy. So I was very fortunate with those. Like at the Winter Gardens at Bournemouth, massive stage. And it's a concert hall, basically. I think it's more or less gone now, alas. But a huge stage. So it was 18 girl dancers and myself. Fronting them, you know, with all the Copacabana or whatever. But then, of course, you get to work with everybody when you work with those guys. But my point is that you're learning from them.
Yes.
And so if you're like, you know, Palladium, we used to do Sunday concerts at the Palladium and stuff. And the girls would go, "Why aren't you in the dressing room with us? You know, we're having a great fun." I said, "Because I'm on the side of the stage and I'm watching Victor Borg. And I'm watching Sammy Davis Jr.
Ah, incredible. Wow.
That's why I'm up there, because I'm watching how they do that, you know. And if you love what we do, you're not going to emulate them, but you're going to say, how do they get that energy? How do they make that work with the audience? And particularly when you do musicals, which I've been lucky enough to do in the West End as well, it's about your audience. You know, they've come in there, haven't they, Steve, like you do, from all sorts of situations, and you kind of got to be aware of that. I love musicals because normally the husbands and wives have had a row on the way there because the husband doesn't want to be there.
They don't want to be there, do they?
Slowly watch them over the 2 hours of getting into it, you know, and it's a beautiful thing to be able to do. Scrooge was one of my favourite parts, and just watching school kids from the age of 5 to 18 with no parents around. And it would never, ever leave me in the scenes where he's in the graveyard and he reviews his life. It's a beautiful scene with beautiful violins.
Were underneath. You Scrooge?
Yeah.
Wow.
And tears would roll down my face. And as I was looking at the kids, they'd have tears rolling down their face at the same time. You know, that's why we do it.
Yeah.
It's for those incredible moments. It's the only time I ever got a standing ovation from a car park. when I finished, we were at Lichfield.
Okay.
We'd finished the show and we were doing those, you know, 11 o'clocks. 11 o'clocks and 2 o'clock.
Oh, no. Wow.
And I was on my way through and the school teacher said, oh, that's the man who played Scrooge. And all the kids just turned around.
That's nice.
I got standing ovation in the car park.
Oh, that's lovely. It's nice to be recognised, isn't it? You're Scrooge. But you're recognised not just for, you know, a show we're obviously going to talk about, The Bill, which is where I first saw you, but you're notable for a lot of different faces. I know you also from Noel's House Party, so you'd always be knocking on that door, wouldn't you?
Eyes and Teeth.
48 live shows.
48. We always wanted it to be you, though, because you always were up for a laugh and always there, you know. Graham Cole would always... Well, you were...
Did it with Andy Paul and did a few on my own, but Noel liked us because we learnt it, because we're actors. Although you've got auto cues all the way around you, you can't really do sketches looking at the auto cue. I had a bit of an argument with Harry Hill about that once. But you used to stand on this 8x10 plinth in darkness, listening to Noel doing the item before us. I never knew how long anything was going to last. And you'd be in semi-darkness and suddenly you'd bing bong, the lights went up, the door opened, you went out to 20 million people.
Wow, that's crazy.
Absolutely extreme.
That's like tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be, but there's no smoke, but you just straight into the lights and it's... Was it daunting? Could you not wait to get out there? Was it a bit nerve-wracking?
That time when... I think only performers kind of... I don't know, the other professions it must be. But when you're standing in the wings and you're waiting, you're doing the act before or whatever it is, and then it doesn't matter if you're in a musical, a play or whatever it is, as soon as your foot hits the stage, your brain tells your mouth, not a clue. don't know what the line is. Don't know what the... I don't know, but that's what we live for, isn't it?
I've got that foot. I have that foot. Both of my feet do that, especially when they're done.
Danger is what puts most people off.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, I mean, I've rewritten Andrew Lloyd musicals before now. Chris, your brain
in the moment. Yeah. No, it does. I'm terrible for remembering things.
Orchestras don't wait, do they? If you're doing a play, you're okay. You can dig yourself out. But the orchestras don't wait. They just carry on. Just carry on and leave you alone. You know?
Yeah, they have to, don't they? it's on loop.
The House Party stuff was amazing. It's about knowing, a lot of young performers are here. It's about knowing your niche. And a lot of times the producer like, do something else. No. We just come and just do our sketches. That's it. We wouldn't get involved in anything else.
Okay. No, nothing. You get gunged. Yes.
To know. Yes. That was the mother-in-law's fault. I think that's quite important is know where you kind of, and Charlie Adams, you know, Paul Adams.
I know Paul, bless him. Yeah. And his father.
Right. He wrote all of those sketches for us, me in mind. And Steve, he came up to me once, we were sitting in the auditorium, loosely termed rehearsals. It's only for camera positions, really. And Charlie came, sat next to me and he said, I've got an idea for you. Okay. So if it works, it's going to be one of those things they're going to be shouting at you in the street. Not kind of one of those type of performers. But and he did. And it came and Laura, my daughter, showed me a sketch where he used it at the end of the sketch. But he started off with Andy, Paul and I coming in, these two inane detectives. And Andy started the sketch off by going, we had a steak out at Heathrow Airport. I had chips with mine. And from that moment on, Charlie would write that in places.
Really?
Three and I were in Wisley, the garden centre,
yeah,
a few months ago. And that little train thing that takes the people that don't want to walk around went past us and the driver shouted, I'll have chips with mine.
Did he? All these years later?
Oh, I don't know, 22 years, 20 years. But I think that's my point, that if it's well written, well delivered, it's in there, isn't it?
It is in there. Charlie Adams was wonderful, such a wonderful writer. He wrote for Bob Monkhouse, Bob Hope, all the Bobs. Yeah. And it was just incredible. I met Charlie.
The nicest men.
He was lovely, wasn't he? Man. Just a sweet man.
That's nice to him.
Yes. Very and sweet. You must have worked with another man on there. And I think Charlie Adams was had something to do with this character joining. So Mr. Blobby. You must have been on there with Mr. Blobby and
plenty of times.
Barry, and, is it Barry? Is Barry, this right-hand man? Is it
Shakespearean actor Barry? Is he actually really? But when you think about it, because when you use Arthur Lager, he's real. I mean, yes. I've worked with you on stage with him. You do. We forget you.
You don't talk to me. You just talk to him. You talk to my right hand.
And Barry was like that. You know, he was the nicest, quiet in the green room. You'd never know that Barry would be inside it. Because when really? He got there, and you never knew. It's a bit like working with Rod Hull, which I had. You never knew when yes. all that muddy bird.
Did you do a scene with it? Did you do Panto with Rod? I saw Rod in Panto.
I did, yeah.
My first yeah. Panto. And
Wrongly,
so,
I think.
Really? And did you have the bird up your, you know?
Oh yeah. I was putting again, although I was into play the giant, I was doing all, I was playing three or four different yes. characters. Again, he's just one of those guys where you've got to get, and that's what television produces, but it's not going to fit like that.
No.
I know Noel had big arguments with the producers toward the end of The House Party, where they wanted it more structured and go, but you know, this technology we've got, we're inside people's homes. It's never been done before.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
Suddenly they're on the television watching themselves.
Great TV. And now Anton Deck do it, don't they? Anton Deck took on that man.
Well, I mean, that's always the thing, isn't it? You and I probably must sit there. I mean, you're a lot younger than I am. But you can sit there and go, this is new and inevitable. No, it's not.
yeah. Yeah, that's why I first saw it.
But if it works, of course you recycle it. Okay.
Yes, yes. It was nice to hear what you said about Mr. Blobby, you know, being Barry, being quiet, because I'm a bit like that in dressing rooms sometimes. And I got signed up for pantomime, and I'm working with CJ Moy, who was an egghead. I've been on Eggheads with him, actually. And yes, and we're doing panto in a small theatre in Milton Keynes. Lucy Rollison, Rollo's daughter's in it. She's Peter Pan.
Oh, Lucy's lovely.
But and me and Arthur Lager are obviously in it, but they surprised us with a brand new guest, and it is Mr. Blobby. So I'm doing panto with Mr. Blobby. He's coming out of retirement. We've all needed to be furloughed over the past year, and even Mr. Blobby needs some money. So
is that coming up?
It's coming up this Christmas, 2021. So I wanted to kind of get a little bit. Maybe if you've got a message, I can. Give him, you know, when I get to the dressing room, and anything banter that you had, it causes chaos, doesn't he? I mean, that's all I've heard.
I think when you think that, you know, I've done loads of Doctor Who things. When you're inside those skins,
yes,
you've got to do something, you know, and you become when you're inside them, you're still acting. And to make Blobby work, I mean, didn't he have a hit record as well?
Yes, he did. Blobby, Mr. Blobby, that was it. Yes.
But Noel Edmonds, good businessman, Noel Edmonds, and I like him very
much. Must have been, yeah. It's a phenomenon.
He toured that show. He literally flew us around the country in helicopters to Butlin's camps. Yeah. And we either did two or three shows a day to 2,500, 3,000 people at the time.
Phenomenal.
With Tony Blackburn and people like that, you know.
Yes.
extraordinary. But Barry, no one, you know, go in the green room and kind of no one would know who he was, and you thought, but this character,
didn't know that man is
there. Is one of the biggest things.
Yes,
in television.
But he was quiet.
Yeah,
that's strange, yeah, isn't
really
it?
Really nice man. But don't you find that quite often? I mean, you know, I've fed most of the comics that you're probably going to ask me about, and 2/3 of them are really quiet, studious.
Yeah, you find that off screen. You do find that, and it's that they hide behind these characters. You know, yeah, they're actors, or I mean, I think actors do it, hide behind a character if they're shy. And ventriloquists do it, clowns, puppeteers. Yeah. They do it more than anyone. So
I mean, you know, like Dawson, what a wordsmith!
Oh, Les, yeah, genius.
Legendary. I did a Sunday concert once, and I used to sing a sort of comedy song to finish it off. You know. My heart is broken, but what could I? And get everyone to wave their hankies and that sort of stuff. Yes. Time. And it was going down so well, this song, this time. It's amazing. But I looked behind me and Les Dawson donned a brown coat and a broom and was sweeping up behind me.
Never gets this reaction. What's going on? Oh, that's nice.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Scene stealer. But I'd like to go back a little bit now, Graham, if you don't mind. You was a Redcoat entertainer.
I get told off by Redcoats, because although I was a Redcoat, it was for a different company. So that was at Camber Sands from Madison's, huge family concern. Right. And I don't know about you, but I had to go down there in March I was given four camps and I could choose which one I wanted to work at.
Really? Wow.
And I just like because it's a family orientated camp and you had people, the regulars that were down there all the time, virtually lived on the campus. But I just like the fact that I was going to be sports organizer during the day, but then had the opportunity of having two spots a week, plus I would be introducing any of the guest artists that came on. So I absolutely loved it. I had such a good time. And of course, I met Cherry down there. She was 16 and I was 21, just 21, I think.
Wow.
And I said, don't fraternise with the campers, don't they?
Yeah.
Strictly forbidden.
We didn't listen.
You tell us that 47 years later.
I know, bless you.
I actually subsequently did it 3 or 4 times because it's just so much fun. And, you know, and I mean, obviously, loads and loads of people started their career, didn't they?
Yes.
Most of the comics certainly did, because you just had to have, I mean, it was there, Steve, I realised I would not, thank you for your kind comment, but would never be a comic in the sense of standing up there and doing it. So I then, that's where I found out about singing songs, but doing a slightly different act. So the songs people might or might not, if a picture paints 1,000 words, then why can't I paint you? But then I would interrupt, why would you do that? Could you see yourself whispering that to your girl's ear hole? You know, tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree.
I'll just sing You Let the Dogs Out. It doesn't go well. Don't do that.
But I love that, because I then also started then just chatting to the audience, you know, like, where did you meet and all that sort of stuff.
So you had
no choice. Yeah. It was all that that kind of stuff, you know. But,
that's amazing. It's great groundwork, isn't it? Sort of getting to work audiences, getting to know your audiences and things. And
well, of course, people would say, oh, it's easy because they knew you. But in fact, because you're doing all the sports stuff, it was a little bit harder to then go out there and actually convince them about being a singer or whatever. So it wasn't as easy as people actually think. Although you got a nice reception when you walked out, there were certainly plenty of people I knew died 1,000 deaths.
Yeah, and you must have seen a lot of comics sort of come and go as well. And you got to enjoy the comics. I mean, there must have been great comedians that were doing the season.
It's fascinating, you know, because on a Wednesday or a Thursday, you have the, you know, like you probably do, you know, you get the same team sort of coming through. Or every fortnight it would be, wouldn't it? Because most people stay for the 2 weeks.
Yes.
And that was quite interesting, because they'd go out there, you know, and absolutely storm the place. And then the second week, nothing. You know,
it's
extraordinary, yeah. Because we often do that, don't we, in theatre? You get backstage, the whole of this audience can't be as miserable as they look.
I know. Are they one family, you think, don't you? Why are they all connected like that?
It's impossible, yeah. But you just need that one or two people with that infectious laughter or whatever it is.
Yes.
And I often say when I arrive, particularly for Panto, to the front of house staff, you're the first meet that the people have. And that's you true. Can put them into the moods as well. You know? And particularly now, you know, as we're coming out of, hopefully, please God, as we're coming out of furlough, when they're opening up, of course, now the staff have always got to be waitresses. It's the only way we can keep the places open, because they can't queue at the bar or anything. So there are quite a lot of theatres that I'm doing, the one-man show in, are saying, you know, do you mind the wait, sort of staff coming through with drinks? So, no, just make it part of the act.
We have to adapt, don't we?
Fourth vodka and tonic, I didn't realise I was that bad.
it's just the kids.
but it's going to be hard on the staff, and I think the theatres got to find extra money, you know, to get the people to do that. But and also, will they make any money?
Yes.
About 400 to the seat theatre, what will they get? About 140 in there, 150 in there with furloughing?
Unless that completely opens, you know. I mean, is it going to open after June? Is that going to be...
It's this latest pandemic, isn't it? As you know, I'm a national health volunteer, which I started March before last. The need out there, I mean, my phone just doesn't stop. The need out there is incredible. And a lot of the time, Steve, it's just someone just needs to know someone cares.
Yes.
And there's a magnificent backup system that the government's put in place. So we've got all sorts of people we can ring if we're worried, particularly about a particular call. Most of the time, people need reassurance or... why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? You know, kind of thing. And we have whole reams of stuff they send us before you get on the phones. Asks for people and things. But I've been with Childline for 36 years, so I'm sort of into
that stuff. You give up a lot of your time, don't you, to do a lot of, it's charity based, but it's stuff that's really close to your heart. And you're very big within the police industry as well. They all know who you are.
Because that's because they gave me a great living, mate.
Yes.
Pretending to be one for such a long time. and I was out with the guys then. I think the loveliest bit about acting has always been in rehearsals, finding the character, researching the characters. If you do musicals like Jesus Christ Superstar, I've played Caiaphas and Pilate in that show, and just researching them, and worked with Dick Tuckey at Ipswich. He was an amazing director, producer. And he said, well, have a look at, historically, have a look at, you know, and Pilate was sort of run by his missus. You know, she was the one that hated Jesus and everything about it. And like most of us, he went home to her. So he was trying to placate her more than anything. But it was interesting. The audience would never know that, but it's interesting in your head as an actor that you're building that character to do that. And I love that part of my job. And it's also that that connection with the audience,
yes,
isn't it? Pilate gets one song, Pilate's Dream. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Oh, it's nice. It's stunning. And you've done so many things. It's I can't really pick a genre because you've done this. So I'm going to try and go through some of the things that you have done. But my best friend, I went to see my friend Jimmy Tamley the other day, and he reminisced about Summer Seasons with you, touring with was it Roy Lance, Tommy Trafford, these guys?
Yeah.
Where was that? You done Whitby and Bridlington with him, and it was like a 12-week season, wasn't it?
I think it might have been with the Folder Roll. If you remember, well, but there would be some people out there jumping up and down remember the Folder Rolls. But you only got to work with the Folder Rolls if you could act, sing, dance, and do all sorts of things.
Right.
Wally Dunn was one of the comics I worked with, really did make me laugh. Roy Lance was a cartoonist, very, very talented guy.
Yes.
And we swapped every week. We swapped so that they could keep the audiences going through. And I loved all that. And
I think Jim said that Les Dawson joined you at one point as well. Was it Les on one of the shows?
Yeah, you do. Because, I mean, we were there for 7 days or something, and then you swap and go off somewhere else. And people say, when you wore the costumes is a thing that I love, because I used to wear Arthur Askey's hat because he was in the Folder Rolls. I mean, I couldn't wear his gear because I'm like 4 foot taller than he was.
Yes.
But I thought, small man with a big head, because I've got quite a big head.
It fits.
but then again, I love, you know, that's just history. That's history of our entertainment business.
Yeah, it's brilliant. He said you're very good at tennis as well, by the way.
Oh, I love tennis. Yeah. I used to play the Pro-Ams.
Do you?
Sir Artois and stuff with all the great tennis players. And you go out, some of the crowds, you know, someone's paid their kid 250 gives 300 quid to charity to come and play with a pro and with a celebrity, you know. And so,
yes.
But I'll be working with the great pros, and they just make you look wonderful. I mean, they can put the ball wherever they want to, but they can make you look an idiot if they feel that way, but they don't. The same if you play cricket with Lords Taverners, you work with, or you play with the England team, with every touring team that's coming in, you know, and they're fantastic on the charity days. Unless we just lost Philip. Prince Philip, I used to play for his 12 all the time, and great. Well, what a raconteur he was. I mean, what a man. I can understand where he got in so much trouble,
because incredible.
He should have been a comic.
He was very funny.
Were you at his dinner that the Grand Order Water Rats gave him?
I was at the 125th anniversary. I wasn't at the dinner, but
amazing.
It must have been incredible.
Had him myself were asked to look after him when he arrived.
Yes.
So you're a little bit sort of apprehensive about that. But he's a lovely man. He does his research, because he knew Roy anyway. So, I mean, that made it a lot easier. But he took this little sip. He had this drink, and he that's all he did. And I said, is that not quite right? So he said, well, I wanted a whatever it was. I won't remember what it was now. And whatever this is, it's not that. And I sort of looked at Roy. And then I said, and I got his equerry. And we went to the bar and said, what actually does he drink? And it was quite complicated. Oh, so we poured that drink. I sidled back alongside, and I took the glass from him and gave him this glass. And then not another word was spoken about it until the dinner. And we're at the dinner, and I was sort of in his eye line, diagonally in his eye line. And another drink sort of arrived and took a little sip. And he looked at me and just went, and he said, oh, that's class.
Acknowledgement.
That's class, isn't it?
That is class. You made the King of England acknowledge you like that. It was so nice. He was, I mean, to me, he was the King of England. So it was, that's amazing. He was a wonderful man, wasn't he? He was, when he welcomed us into the palace, you know, 2014, and in his living room. You know, we're walking around, there's hundreds water rats sort of celebrating the fact that, you know, he is a companion rat. And I think everyone has a little anecdote from that night. And it was just, he was naughty, wasn't he? He was just a funny man.
I couldn't actually make that night. I was working, unfortunately.
Oh,
yeah. But Charles as well, you know, he would always, and when I was King Rat, we went to the garden party. And he came up and was King Rat. And said, "Ah, are you Stan's emblem, sir?" And he just went like that with his lapel. It was underneath.
Oh, really?
I said, "Oh, I was hoping to get 250 quid off you."
He got you. See, he was ready. He was ready.
Yeah.
The first time I met you was at a Water Rats ball, and you gave me a mountain bike. Do you remember that? So I won a raffle. I won a raffle, and the prize was a mountain bike. And the fact I won a mountain bike was not what I was telling people the next day. It was Graham Cole gave me a mountain bike. That's what I was saying. That's what was the exciting part. You brought the prize over to me.
Were you like it? Were you a boy?
I was four. Yes. No. No. It was. I think I was about. It was early 30s. I was. And I was.
No, you still got it.
I was 37. I actually gave it to my brother-in-law that Christmas. So it was. It saved me 100 quid.
Oh, bless you.
No,
oh, they were great gigs, weren't they?
Amazing, amazing.
I had such
balls.
A wonderful night on my ball. That is, they're so, so special. You'll get there one day, mate. You'll be kicking around one day and have yourself.
Oh, bless you. This is an incredible dream to have. But if you can you tell us about the Water Rats? Because you were King Rat, you've worked your way up, you know, and you do work your way up in the Grand Order. It's an important thing to be part of, but to be invited and voted to be King Rat, it must be an incredible feeling.
Yeah. Huge. I think for those listening, the Grand Order Water Rats, you know, as I said, when I was in Sunday concerts, you'd have the greats, you know, of our industry coming through with this little rat, you know, that you've got on your lapel there, this little gold rat, and you're, wow. And to answer your question a few questions ago, you do charity work because you want to give back. You're just so grateful for your life and for what it's given you. And it was actually Burt Whedon. I was doing a gig for the Water Rats, don't know what, and where, but he came up and said, you know, I'd like to nominate you to be a grant, which is how you get in, be a Water Rat. Would you be interested? And I thought, well, yeah. But then you don't hear anything for months.
No. Or years sometimes.
That's gone, by the by. And then I got a phone call and went in. I think what was amazing really was that most, like when I do my one-man show, it's called So You Think You Know Me.
Yes.
And most, of course, I think like in the hall when I first went in, you make your acceptance speech, or just see me as being an actor, you know, and quite a lot of the variety of people look down on us actors, don't they? Right, they got to be in the war, action, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, really?
But then, of course, when I was able to go from 1974 and start to list the people that I work with and the fun that I had, you know, Jimmy Edwards and people, I mean, real greats of our theatre.
Justified.
22 yeah. When I fed Jimmy Edwards, you know, in Panto.
And what was he eating?
But, you know, it wasn't so much about that. It was that when we first got for rehearsals, we kept doing it, where were we? Richmond Theatre. Ah, we got into rehearsals. I think about 22 or something like that. And the company manager came up and said, "You've got two jobs, Cole." "Yes, sir." "Learn the script. So that if Mr. Edwards ever looks at you, you will put him back on script if he's gone off on one of his." "Okay." "And secondly, keep him away from the optics." So I used to knock his door, Steve. "In!" He had his penetrating voice. And I go to his room. And at any one time, there would be Eric Sykes, Joan Sims, and it could be anyone sat in his dressing room. And you just think, let's stay here. Get the pants out. And wow. On his wall, his optics were the size of Jeroboam's. I've never seen, I mean, they're huge. And he's there all the time. "Do you want a drink?" "No, so I think, you know, we sort of better go and, okay." And we go out and we do this thing. I bet he was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And a war hero.
Yes, yes.
He's a pilot in the war. And stuff. But it was just,
that's incredible.
Fortunately, in Panto, I've worked with all the Carry On team. That is just extraordinary. And they asked me once, and I suppose I'm in my 30s, with Kenneth Connor and people like that, would I do the drill routine, you know, which is an old crazy gang with all the rifles.
Okay. Is it very wordy, is it?
And they said, no, it's all action.
Oh, okay.
It's all about, hey, shoulder arms, hey, look, slip up. It's all that stuff.
Right.
And, of course, I said, well, I've never been in the services. It's all right for you lot. I've got to learn that first. And there was a character who used to be around. I won't remember. It might have been Eli Sly or something. But Eli was always the guy who was on the end for the
Eli Woods, is it? Yeah.
Eli Woods, well done.
Yes.
And he would always be 100th of a second. That's where the guy from Dad's Army got it. 100th of a second behind everybody else. And I had to be that guy.
Okay, right.
So I had to learn the whole routine and then be able to just, out the corner of my eye, watch them all do it, and then just be 1/2 second after them. Because it was almost like Pike, sort of character before, yeah. Pike.
Don't tell him Pike. Stage. Really? Wow.
Glorious, isn't it? I mean, flipping it and be paid to do that.
It's incredible, isn't it, to be part of variety. I mean, you've got, you know, so many connections within what you do as well. And you're very well known in Doctor Who, and you do the Doctor Who conventions. People know you as that actor. And your book, your book On the Beat, is an incredible story, and it tells of you, you know, playing parts in Doctor Who. So did you enjoy doing the makeup? Do you do some without the makeup as well, or the suits?
I think what was more interesting was, again, being at the beginning of it all. So Amy Roberts was one of the designers on it. So being with her very early on and talking about Melker, it was a character that I created, which was she created and I went inside. He was the master's time machine. Yeah, so right. it's a little bit, I think people go on a bit, but, you know, I was a jobbing actor. If I didn't work, the family didn't eat. This 18 months for you and all of us in the profession, I don't think, and we can't get any furlough. I haven't got any, I don't know about you, but I've got nothing, absolutely nothing.
Really?
And all the theatres I've been talking to, so I've been doing this this work with them, doing some videos and stuff to show the public what it's going to be like if you walk in, you know, what the new system's going to be and all that sort of stuff. And most of our theatres have got nothing either. Now, where this 500 million went, don't get me started.
I suppose it went
to the theatres. It must have gone to the big boys.
Yeah.
Or those that could shout the loudest. It certainly hasn't filtered through to the theatres that you and I go
small
and work.
Community theatres. Yeah.
Exactly. Is the community stuff. And that's, of course, where it should start.
Yeah, that's what suffered most, isn't it?
Sort of the other end, as it were.
Yes.
But, you know, Grand Order, Water Rats, all that stuff, all the charity stuff, the post-traumatic stress, which is a new charity we started 3 years ago for the police, post-traumatic stress 999, just for the blue lighters, police, ambulance and paramedics, is nuts. I'm talking to them all the time. It's so hard out there, Steve, for them.
Yeah.
A lot of the coppers are saying, you know, that the social care system has completely broken down in this country. There's nowhere to send anybody. The mental health of our country is in such a mess. It's going to be years before that's sorted.
I must have been tripled in this time, more than tripled.
To be ahead of that and sort of be planning for it is fascinating. And the same thing with the Doctor Who's. You know, if you're inside that gear, like I said, you know, I've been a Marshman, I was Cyberman, I was all sorts of things. I mean, I was a Cyberman before they had all the electronics. You know, you have to be so precise with where you put the gun because some poor little soul has got to draw the line on. Line of fire. Long before CGI and all that stuff,
yes,
was invented, you had to be very precise. But of course, when you're inside that gear, Marshmen, it was unbelievably hot in the studios. It was based on a diver suit with lots of rubber stuff, and then you had a hood, helmets.
It looks so heavy, and you got pictures.
It was hugely hot. Mm-hmm. But I've got a warped sense of humour, as you know. So you kind of got to treat it like doing a radio play.
Yeah,
because like, no one talks to you. You're in that stuff and you're sat in the corner of the studio, not a single solitary. So the wardrobe would come up to you and sort of with a little glass of water, you know, and sort of with a straw every now and again, try and stop you falling over.
Yeah. You must have felt like Mr. Blobby, Barry from Mr. Blobby. You just sat there, no one talks.
Exactly.
Yes.
But it's when you hear the kids going on about, you know, hiding behind the settee because the Cybermen were on that, and you know you were that. It's fantastic because nobody knows. It's uncredited most of the time. You know, when the credits fly through,
no credit.
No, don't get credited for that sort of stuff. But it's fascinating, you know, walking rehearsal studios at Acton behind Tom Baker, and he's the Doctor Who at the time, and the director just shouting at you. We're all in t-shirts, you know, and jeans and stuff, and little marks on the floor of where it's going to go, where they're going to put caves and things. So you have to be quite precise of where you're going, so the camera crew are watching you and that stuff. And the director just shouts at you, 40, 45 people in the room with you, give Tom something to work on, for God's sake. Make her sound like a Marshman. So I'm walking behind this great actor, Tom Baker, great.
If only they could see this. That was
jobbing.
Yeah. How do you sound like a marsh man? You know, it was just a slushy marsh.
In actual fact, afterwards, there was no real sound at all. It was all electronics, you know, that they did with it. Yeah. But it was fascinating to go from rehearsal rooms and then go into the studios. And Doctor Who was never treated terribly well, I thought, by the BBC. Sort of 5:30 on a Saturday, all the lights would go off, irrespective of how far in the scene you were or anything else. And it was always under pressure because there was never enough money. I mean, there was, or is now, but there was never at the time, you know. Blake Seven sort of fell into that same place as I was lucky enough to work on that show as well. And but they had an even worse budget.
Did they really?
And you just feel for the actors that are there, you know, you just got to try and make it as real. But strangely enough, I think if anything, when you work with kids in Panto now, they're all so used to these laptops and playing all these games and things on it that they forget you're real, you know, they forget you're human. I mean, you must get it when you're in Panto, you know, for the first 10 minutes, they're kind of, and then they realize, we can't
turn it over. This remote control is not working.
But I think being inside that gear, you know, you're thinking of the actors, but then you go in and you do a Doctor Who convention, you know, and they're like as nutty for us that were inside the outfits. Yeah, not if David Tennant and people like that were there, of course. But I mean, Dave talking about it. And do you know that thing, Steve, where you don't want to break, you like that illusion to remain. You don't want to break it all by telling them, I don't know, you know.
Like Arthur Lager's not real or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my missus always says of your characters, you know, they're always so lovely. You know, we're talking about you over lunch today. Then I was going to come and talk to you, and you're saying all your characters just so lovely, you can't help but you don't have grotesque little characters at all, do you? They're all really loving.
Well, I have now. I've got a Boris Johnson one. he's a spare in the spare room at the moment. So,
A bit like his life.
Yeah, nothing's happening, and so that's very lovely of Cherry to say. I like to because you do get typecast as a ventriloquist. Somebody in a Warner's part the other night, they sent a message backstage to say, is he a scary ventriloquist? What sort of ventriloquism does he do, you know? And I think what she means was, has he got those Lord Charles type wooden characters that scare the hell out of people like Chucky does, you know? And so, but I see what Cherry's talking about. She's talking about the soft Muppety style characters. Arthur Lager's almost like a cartoon, you know, because he looks real, but he's animated and... You know, I've got nothing scary really in my.
It's show. The way you guys work them, though, isn't it?
Keep them alive.
I remember who's the young guy who's done so. He's done the played in Panto for the last 3 or 4 years.
Paul Zerdin. Yeah. Sam. Yeah, he's great.
I've been around with him a few times, you know, and his puppets as well are the same. I don't know, what do you call them, puppets? I don't know how you guys.
Only when they're not here. Yeah, I call them dummies. Really. they don't offend. I mean,
but your mind goes back. You know, if you talk about ventriloquism, it goes all the way back to Lord Charles and
Ray Allen. Yeah, yeah.
And lovely man. Really nice man.
He was a gentleman. He was immaculate as well, wasn't he, Ray? When he turned up to a theatre, he was already in a suit and had changed to get into another suit. And he had certain ways of not getting dirty trousers when he changed and makeup on his collar. Everyone's told me stories of Ray and.
Because he really wanted the aristocracy, and he really wanted it to be exactly. They wanted to think that's where that, you know, that's where he came from, but it's such a gift that you guys have. You know, Roger, I love Roger De Courcy. I love working with him. You know,
and the bear's not really. He's a great comic, isn't he, Roger? But he doesn't want to get the bear out, but he knows he has to. But you know, the bear is just a bear, but he does bring that bear to life still.
And it's got, I know he hates bringing out, but you've got to. It's amazing. But, you know, I've worked with Basil Brush, you know, when it was Owen. You only could address him as Basil. And he wasn't nowhere near, didn't have his arm up Basil's bum.
Yeah.
Apart from that, you know, you had to address him as such. I love that. We did a panto a little while ago with Zippy and George.
Oh, did you?
Rainbow.
Yeah. It was the work with Ronnie LeDrew on that, I think.
I was so pleased. Yeah,
wonderful guy.
Your kid to be working with them. And of course, Sooty, you know, and
Sooty and Co. You've been on the show. I was watching it with my kids actually a couple of months ago, and one of your episodes come on with you and Sooty.
Belgrado, whatever it is.
Yes.
Burglary backwards. Yeah. Kept breaking into the house and leaving stuff. That's very funny. Sweep was my favourite.
Yeah, yeah, we love. He was cheeky. He was the cheeky one, wasn't he?
Steve, the sadness is you start to understand what he's talking about.
You could understand the squeak. It's weird, isn't it? It's, Ronnie LeDrew did that. Ronnie LeDrew had been Sweep at one point, you know, so he got Sweep on this audio podcast. But when Sweep was talking, I understood what Sweep was saying. He's got that magical technique of making you believe the words, you know. But
the thing that I love about the Bill, and I never tire of people coming on and talking about them, it's beautiful. I had two yesterday on Facebook, and they're just going, the memories of sitting with my granddad watching the Bill, you know, and you can't pay for that, can you?
It's wonderful. We always sat there with our family watching you, and it was a comedy show as well, wasn't it? There were some serious stories in there, and you got some great messages across. But the camaraderie between you and the other characters on the show was just a wonderful thing. And you've done your own stunts, didn't you? You became a first class driver. You were a great driver for the show.
Well, I was very fortunate in that I've always loved motor cars. So I've had a racing license for over 50 years.
Really? Wow.
So, and Noel Edmonds, when I was doing the house party for him, he would fly me all over the country to go and do celebi drives on the Saturday in the touring cars. The crowds could walk around the pits and sort of chat to you, you know, and the guys go, oh, I've got a Cosworth, and I bet it's just like the one you're racing, isn't it? Yeah. It's nothing like the ones we're racing, but anyway, but I love that.
Stock car racing.
Well, I've done that as well, yeah. But what I loved about the group, they gave me a little radio mic, and I would whiz around the track. And so, okay, I'm coming out. I'm going to overtake this idiot on my left-hand side. Now you can see him in this long run. Number 34, I'm going to overtake him on the next bend. So give me a cheer as I come past him. And it was fantastic to watch. So I had all that. And when I joined the Bill, I've always cited many times to you already, I love the research part of it. And the Met were wonderful to me. I went out with them hundreds of times on all sorts of initiatives and drugs raids, all sorts of things. They were wonderful to me. But the biggest part was when they said they wanted Snap to be this area car driver, I went to Hendon when the driving school was there. I actually did that course 8 times with the guys.
Really?
And when I tell the coppers that, they go, you were that bad.
Yeah. Why did it take so long to get it right?
What people don't understand, but yeah, every time the government changed the system, all the cops would go back to the classroom and learn the law and everything about it. Yeah. So they're endlessly on courses. So going out with the guys, it was the same, you know, driving or whatever, the change with the systems that they have for blocking, you know, the bandit cars, as we like to call them, all that sort of stuff. And just the camaraderie again and being with the guys. But then going out and around Chiswick, all those roundabouts at Chiswick.
Yeah.
And you'd be in an unmarked car and you had to keep as close to the bandit car as you could, but the public don't know you're a police officer. So you have to drive within the parameters of everybody else, but keep up on the training. And the hardest thing is they had to do a running commentary to pass their final tests. And you've got a guy sat beside you with a big long tick list of stuff, and they're doing this all the time. And it's so unnerving in your head.
No.
But what you have to do from the minute he says go until he says stop, you have to tell them everything you see on the road. There's a woman, I can see a woman walking down left hand side. There's a car just parking up there. He might open the door. There's two cars ahead of me indicating to turn right. I mean, everything you see, and they are marking stuff that you've missed.
It's like doing a speeding course, you know, so, when you're naughty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've done the IAM course as well. Yes. And then when IAM, it was all retired traffic cops that ran the whole system anyway. But it really heightens. And Cher has always sat beside me now going, slow down, slow down. So I'm looking and, you know, because what they do when the guys are doing the high pursuit stuff, if someone immediately ahead of you does something stupid, the chance of avoiding them is going to be luck of where you can go. You're looking at the car ahead of them who suddenly decides he wants to turn right, just as you're about to. And people act really stupid when the blue lights go on and the siren's gone. So normally you'll see the guys will put the blue lights on first.
Sweating.
We'll do the two tones a little bit later on. But the coppers would always say to me, and I've been out with them doing the courses, why do you do this? You're not paying any attention. I think it's got nothing to do with me, mate. It's the directors. They always want us to park for some godforsaken reason on the other side of the road and run across the road. I don't know why. They just think it looks better. But hey,
that is fair.
And the guys, particularly the instructors, will say, but we told you, if you're doing a pursuit with someone, particularly if they're on foot, and you can't hit them with the door, you're not close enough. it's all about that stuff.
That's funny.
I love being with them, and I have some lovely comments from, you know, that I'll walk around, Steve, and I'll get really young coppers come up and say, you know, did loads of training videos from which they're all still watching us.
Yes.
And you can't pay for that.
And the police stop series as well. It's a documentary, isn't it? You've done a lot of those, didn't you?
17 or something like that.
Yes.
That was Bill Rudgard Productions, the first ones. And he paid fortunes for these clips. And when we used to go and record them, I used to do the voices for them. And in the end, I then were out in front presenting as well. But they would have a Scotland Yard, whatever he was, commander or something, sat beside us saying what we should do. You know, this vehicle was going down the A21 at 33 miles an hour. This, of course, I went, no, mate. No one's going to listen to that. And there's this great clip that we used to show them saying, this is what we're about. And it's a car going down with a caravan. You see the caravan start to rock. And then it smashes one side, smack, and goes into 1,000 pieces. And the commentary that I made was, this was a slight mistake on behalf of the driver. That's what you need.
Humour.
Like me, you do this corporate stuff, you know, and it's that kind of humour that people want, and
it works.
People will remember stuff if it's funny. You very kindly said about, you know, I think Hollis and Stamp got the best lines on the bill. It was just a great deliverer of... And you know, when you pick a script up, Steve, you know, and you're going to, I remember one particularly was a house where they put people with learning difficulties in, and the bill used to highlight a lot of that stuff. You're quite right. And Stamp's back at this house about the third time, so he's getting a little bit angry now. And we're outside, and they're protesting outside this house, and he pins this actor against the wall and just says, okay, first of all, you're obstructing the police officer in the course of his duties, and secondly, why don't you pick up someone your own size, if that's biologically possible. Beautiful.
That's nice. That's a line in the bill.
You
want to
deliver it.
Yeah.
You really want to deliver it. And
they're good writers, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had 60-odd writing there. And a lot of the coppers were saying, a guy came on Facebook this morning and just said, I loved it when... they always call me Tony, which is fair. I mean, Tony used to come out the back of the car with us, you know, because he didn't just sit in the back, he'd get out and get involved.
No. But, so 25 years on the show, though, it's an incredible amount of time to be. Your face is out there for that long, and that's why we all know your face, and you must get stopped still every day. Everyone knows your face.
I love it from the public's point of view. It's been a bit of a pain, if I might say,
in
getting other work.
Okay. Well, you can't be typecast. I mean, panel shows have you, and game shows love you. You've done Weakest Link, Blankety Blank.
They did. When you're in the show, when you leave the show, it's like you didn't exist.
Really?
It is extraordinary. I mean, everything stops. And I'm sure all the actors, you know, whether in soaps or whatever, will say the same thing to you. And getting another role on television is like, you know, I've done Law and Order, I've done Holby, but only because the producers and directors know me.
Yes.
And I mean, the Holby character was fantastic. He was an antiques dealer, you know, and got involved with an end of a story. And Alex Walkinshaw, who played Smithy, who's now in Holby, and had the two of us together. And apparently it went way up at the BBC about whether the audience would ever accept us working together. And of course, you know, give our audience a bit of savvy, you know. And it's down to me. Larry O'Shea was a character, and it's down to me to make it. I went absolutely mahogany. Do you know that guy that does the antiques? I don't know what his name is, but he's
the one with the hat.
He always looks as though he's like been covered in teak oil.
David Dickinson. David Dickinson.
Yes, him, that's the guy. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I had him in my mind. So when I sat down and started chatting to the makeup people. Because I'm nearly always tanned, as you know. I don't know what it is, but I'm nearly always...
Natural, yeah.
Yeah, I tell people it's Italian blood. It's not, but I tell people that.
It's not. It's Clacton by the sea.
I've just got to walk out in the sun. My daughter's exactly the same for like 5 or 10 minutes. And And Cherry moans like, she goes red like a lobster. And that. But anyway, and so I said to makeup, again, well, maybe we should like bouffant the hair a little bit. And they, really? Yes. Well, most actors don't want to. No. It's not about me. It's about the character. And I think, you know, I did a wonderful little piece in 23 Walks, which is a movie with Alison Steadman that came out a few months ago. And that was the same thing. You know, the director just knew me and called me and just wanted me to play her husband in a scene and stuff. But it's, I don't know whether it's going all the way back full circle, but I don't know if it's because the producers and directors don't come from our world now, or whether, as Cherry says, you know, you're old school. You don't have character actors anymore. You know, when you see like people from, I don't know, whatever, they're always themselves.
Yeah.
And you sort of go, only a few get away with that. You know, you think of Broadbent and guys like that. You know, they're the actors that I look at. And,
sure, yeah, yeah, great names.
That's kind of how I sort of view myself, if you, not his caliber, but I mean that you give me the role and I go and play it and that's the fun of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and on stage, I play 60-odd characters on stage, you know, and that's the fun. You know, I used to do weekly rep and fortnightly rep in my early career.
Yes.
So you'd start on the Monday rehearsing. You'd have 4 days and then you start talking about the show that's going to follow that. You're open either Friday night or Saturday. And then Monday, you're going Monday morning, they do any alignments or script changes they wanted to do for that show. You then start Monday afternoon rehearsing the second one. So you've got two full shows.
Wow.
In your, and then you walk out, you know, the next night thinking, who am I?
Eyes and teeth.
Did you enjoy being on a long run like the Bill? Would you just say now, EastEnders phones up, would you say, yeah, I'll go and do 10 years on EastEnders or a year? And is that something you'd love to do?
I think as most jobbing actors, most jobbing performers will tell you, who knows? The thing is that I didn't join the Bill and it was going to go on for 25 years. And like many people on television, my contracts were 6 monthly options on the company part for 25 years. Any 6 months, they could have gone by. Yeah, whether you want to live your life like that and drag your family.
It's frustrating, isn't it? Yeah, not knowing.
They always had the power to let you go. I was very fortunate that, you know, they saw something in Stamp and I was lucky enough that you then had that. But I do have to say, Steve, they were very kind to me. They would let me still go and do the plays and stuff. They didn't like me doing rehearsals, but they didn't mind me doing sort of the plays and things. Because it's sort of, and also in my contract, I was one of the few actors because I'd already done Panto throughout my career. That's when I started in 1974. My first job was at the Hippodrome in Bristol with Dora Bryan, Bertie Hare, Mark Winter.
That's an amazing venue as well, the Bristol Hippodrome, yeah, isn't it? Beautiful. Love it there.
And so in my contract, they still allowed me to go off and do, although we had a two-week shutdown anyway over Christmas, to allow me to do Panthers. And a lot of the actors would be moaning about, you know, why do you go? Well, if you're going to do it, go and try. And a few did and came back to me doing that again. It's the energy it takes.
It's hard work. Yeah, it is hard work. I can't wait to get back to Panto. But you've done so many shows. You've worked with variety shows and pantomimes and the names that you've worked with as well. And they've worked with you. Yeah, Stanley Baxter, Joan Savage and Bernie Clifton. You've done a season with them as well. Yeah. You must have stories.
Joan Savage and Bernie Clifton together. That was an experience.
It must have been.
He's a character. And he was amazing. Again, I was employed as a singer. And he used to do, you know, I don't know if he still does the Red Shadow, you know, One Alone with Me. And I actually toured with John Hanson in his musicals. And I was singing this song, love song. And I saw him in the corner of my eye in the wings. And here we go. And he got the cape on and the little cat on his shoulder. And he walked on. And as he walked past me, he let the gas go, which used to scare all the CO2 gas underneath. He let the gas go. And unbeknown to me, he'd filled up the footlights with these little round polystyrene balls, thousands of them. And it was like snow. They went everywhere. And I'm trying to sing this song with every time I took a breath, another mouthful of these things. But like, and Joan Savage, Bernie came up to me, I've got an idea. So Joan, she's very short-sighted. She took a very funny comedian and impressionist. And she's doing a singing act. And we had a 5-piece, I think, in the pit with us. And Bernie said, I need your help. Okay. So we slowly replaced the musicians with mannequin dummies, all in Flying Tuxedo.
He's such a naughty man.
By the end of the number, there was just the violinist left. It was too nervous. I mean, the audience could see what we were doing, and Joan just thought she was going a storm. She came off in the wings, and I thought she was going to have a real go at us, but she said to Bernie, "I know they play bad, but they're really off tonight." That's what she said.
Didn't realise.
Until we told her. But,
oh, that's genius. He is a prankster, Bernie Clifton, but he... Every prank he does is different. He doesn't repeat the pranks. He just comes up with a new one every day. He's a genius.
Enormous props.
Yeah, yeah.
He loves enormous props. And he used to fill that theatre, Sparrow's Nest, with... He's got like a chest, again with CO2. And he got... And I bought... Of course, we're near the sea. I bought this. And I thought it was a good idea. And it's an inflatable man, but it's 22 foot long. And it just comes out of this case.
Really?
Just, and he ignores it. It's coming out behind him. He just sort of pushes the arm away, and it fills the auditorium.
That's amazing.
It's genius.
That's fascinating. Genius. Yeah. I needed a giant Arthur Lager, actually, an inflatable one. So I need to talk to Bernie. He must know. Where's he get them blown up?
Yeah, he's the man.
You've done these shows you've been on, Dame Edna. You worked with Dame Edna, and the variety was amazing, wasn't it, back then? And sitcoms as well, Graham. I'm trying to fit in as much as I can, because people just think that you've been on the bill. You've done so much, but only Fools and Horses. You know, you mentioned these shows.
I think one of the things, again, if young actors ask, you can't really advise them, can you? Because it's a different time.
It is now, yeah.
Area. You know, the rep theatres aren't there. But if you were working the big shows, or you did the big tours, as I did around the country, of musicals and things, you know, you work with ASMs, and the ASMs went on to the BBC or ITV and stuff and became floor managers, producers, and they took their name. I mean, one of the things, if I'm known for anything, it's that I want to know what I'm doing. I want to come in. I want to do it. I want to be around professionals. I want to do it and go home in the shortest space of time possible. I don't need to know what's my motivation, because that's my job to know that before I start.
Of course.
During rehearsals, that's my job to know that.
Yeah.
And when I come in, I've come with an idea, and then the director, or if you're working with Harry Hiller and those guys that have their own ideas, and you marry what you want to do. But a majority of them, you know, why would you ask me if you didn't want me?
Yes, they want you. They've got your face and your voice, and people that don't know about your voice. You were, when I joined the Water Rats, you were at the Dominion Theatre doing A White Christmas. That's an incredible best show to be part of.
Yeah. And first Englishman to play General Waverley.
That were you?
What a magnificent part that was. You've got two massive speeches, beginning and the end. And the end speech was beautiful, because it's about leaving his soldiers behind. And there were moments in that when I was making that speech, again, a solo violin came underneath the speech.
Yes.
And the words were wonderful, but when the violin started, the tears would just roll down my face. But hey, that's also part of the job, but you know. And I could just see flashes of white. 4,000 people were in the Dominion Theatre. And it was ladies remembering husbands, brothers, cousins, you know, that didn't come
so
back.
So powerful.
Beautifully written part. And, to just have the whole chorus when you're standing there, you know, they've come to try to rescue his hotel, country club. And you've got that, "We'll follow the old man wherever he wants to go, wherever he wants." It's just beautiful. And you've got to be amazing. A full time. Not to be moved by it.
And, sing with an orchestra as well. It must have been, because the Dominion's huge, isn't it? Such a huge venue.
We were asked there. We used to do the collections on behalf of, you know, Royal Variety Show and theatres. And I used to go out after the show in my uniform at the front of the house, and we made like 75 grand or something from wonderful punters just putting money in the box. And
amazing.
And it's one of the first times that a lot of the chorus girls and boys came out. So we usually do this on our own, you know, those that sort of headliners kind of don't come out, you know. But I always do that after the panto.
Yeah. People that's the difference.
I usually come out in like the King's gear or whatever. I've never been in King's gear, but you know what I mean? His finale outfits. And I love those moments, you know, and it also gives the audience chance to say whether they enjoyed it or not. And I paid 35 quid for this, and you feel you were done.
Well, it's amazing. If people want to know a lot more, it's in your book, On the Beat. Your autobiography is brilliant. It's such a nice read. And, you know, for your fans out there that haven't got it yet, they can still get your book. But to get to This Is Your Life and Michael Aspel walking in, and Michael Aspel has been on this show, so that's coming out later this year. A great chat with him, because I was a big fan of This Is Your Life, and he was wonderful. So what is it like when he walks up with this red book and he gets you?
Well, of course, the trouble with the bill is that, you know, we maybe worked three or four various units on the same day. So your head is in three different places, three different stories, and you're trying to remember where you're coming from, where you're going to, and all that clobber. And on the day they called me in, I wasn't supposed to be in. So I was kind of like, not in a mood, but kind of like, what's gone wrong, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And of course, I knew what's going on in the building. So I mean, to keep that quiet was extraordinary feat. And Cherry, I've never trusted her since. She was like 3 months.
Yeah,
3 months of smuggling pictures out of the house and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I'm like that with my 40th surprise party, you know. You feel like you can't trust them. How did they do this? Yeah,
true. But we're in a multi-story car park doing a scene which I'd only learned 2 minutes beforehand, because it was a scene was never going to be shown, but they said they needed a fill-in scene. And so I'm doing that, and then I hear this other car coming up the ramp halfway through a speech of mine. I think, if they're going to ask me to do it again, whatever idiot let this car up the ramp is going to be, like, you know, mentioned in dispatches. And it had to be a police car. What the? And it was Tom Butcher, who played Loxton, was driving it. And I didn't even notice who got out the back of the car, who walked up. And you don't expect, I mean, to be honest, Steve, you don't. You know, all you've done is
not expecting
you've
it,
lived your life and you survived. And all the time then, they take your mobile phone away from you. You're locked in the studios at, well, they take you to a little hotel first in Richmond, and then they take you to the studios. But you're not allowed to talk to anyone. And in all sincerity, you just sit there thinking, how are they going to fill half an hour?
We've done an hour and a half, and we're only talking, you know. I'm sorry.
Sorry, but, I do.
You know, I think you're either modest or you just forgot how much you've done. It's an incredible career that you've had. And so for him to walk in and to tell people and have all these people walking on, little and large, that have these fond memories of working with you. And it's testament to you as a person, you know, because everyone I've spoke to about that have worked with you, that they adore you, and you are such a graceful guy. And it's so nice to hear that, you know, in the business. It really is.
That's very kind of you to say, and them to say. Bless you, mate. I think you just got to you've got to behave. You know, I worked on big movies with Vincent Price, Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee. And you look at those guys and you see how they conduct themselves around the set, and you can't get bigger than that. So you think, you know, there's actually, I don't think our business is so hard, and it's so tough on the youngsters coming through. When they used to come on the show, I did, do whatever you want to do. I'll kill to my character. It's your scene, not mine. You do what you want to do, you know, because that's how I was treated. And very special, you know, afterwards, the Pantheon, Jimmy Edwards calling you into his dressing room and just going, you know, I've never felt so confident on stage, having you there, you know, knowing that you've sort of got my back.
That's nice. Amazing, it's nice to get that feedback.
I mean, it's some of the stories from him are hysterical.
Yeah.
Because I mean, he didn't care. He wasn't there for the kids.
No, I'm repeatable.
I do a story of people. That's what I love about the one man show, is that I kind of open up to the audience, so they can ask me whatever they want to ask. So it changes, you know, the show changes.
So every night's different, or every afternoon.
I've got clips and stuff, you know, that I show. But yeah, it's a bit like talking to you. The brain just goes off on them.
Yeah,
it's a bit like, if you read the autobiography, it does the same thing. You can see it's written by me, because it flips about all over the place and then it comes back again.
It's nice to hear it from your own mouth, though, isn't it? And so You Think You Know Me is it's an event, and people can actually book this in theatres. They can come and see you in theatres, talking about your whole career and your life. And
I mean, you know, I've got people coming to Clacton at the end of this month, and then we go to Beccles, and then we come down to Eastbourne.
Oh, brilliant.
At the Langham Hotel. But of course, the thing is that these poor souls booked this 2 years ago.
I know, yeah.
And
yeah,
they've held on to the ticket. So I'm thinking, what's going to be my opening lines? You haven't aged at all.
So where were we? Yeah. It was
like... Where did you keep the tickets all this time, and could you find them?
Well, that was one hell of an interval. Yes.
Yeah. It's amazing that people come. But they love live, don't they? You know, and all the nonsense we've gone through for the last 18 months, to come out there. It's needed. I think our industry it's about live. You know, you can't be there. Whether it be theatre in a play or musical, or whether it be what you and I go out and do on a daily basis, you know, it's very
amazing. It makes you feel good. And I went back to stage this week, and it's starting to get the applause and the laughter again. It's like it never went away. So when you get back up there, and I hope you get back up there soon, you deserve it. You know, you deserve the applause.
I've not been there for 18 months, mate. Is it quite scary? Because I'm getting quite sort of like, blimey, I haven't done this.
When you're standing in the wings, you're like, when you start to hear the people talking again and the lights are on, the curtains are opening, you hear your name and you come out, you will just, you know, it's going to be like you just met up with your best friend after a year. It's incredible. The feeling is just like, you know, when you went out there and, you know, with the Noel's house party and the lights come on. It's just like you're doing that again.
I was a lot younger then.
Yeah, well, we've been sat here waiting in the wings for over a year, haven't we? So we've all aged 5 years, apparently. But you don't look it. You look great. And so it's brilliant. But when you go back out there, Graham, they're going to love you and appreciate every moment. Because they know we really want to be there, you know. We've been waiting too long. So.
Yeah,
it was amazing. So thank you so much.
Lovely chatting to you, mate. I miss your company immensely.
Oh, bless you, Graham. And it's wonderful to have you on Eyes and Teeth. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your story. And we'll put everything on that we can share of yours, get people to buy your book and come and see your shows.
We've got lots of editing to do, haven't we? I'm really sorry.
Do you know what? No, this may be one of the longest shows that I put out there, but we don't have to edit. We don't have to edit much. You've got so much, and we've not touched on, you know, half of your career. So thank you so much for being on the show. Graham Carr, OBE.
Thank you, Steve. It's been great being with you. And thanks, everyone, for watching. And I hope you enjoyed it half as much as I have. Thanks, Steve.
What a wonderful man.
Eyes and Teeth.
Thanks to Graham Cole for joining me today. And to find out more about his touring, talks, pantomimes and productions he's starring in, then go to Facebook and find Graham Cole OBE or Twitter at Graham Cole Act. There's also a website run by his fans that is on a break at present, but you can find a lot of details on there, as well as a biography and a list of work he's been involved with. And that is at www.stampers.org.uk. Today's quote comes from past water rat and wonderful actor, Wurzel Gummidge, to Doctor Who, John Pertwee. Here is a bit of advice. Don't be afraid to stand out. Don't be afraid to be memorable. Do it by being someone people can depend on, by being professional, but don't be afraid to be yourself and make your mark. You do not have to conform. Getting a strong reputation and being someone people remember will do you more good, whatever your profession, than anything else. When people you have known or you have worked with move up the industry, them remembering you will do more favours and provide more opportunities than anything else. Be a good chap. Be a good chap they remember. That is the trick. Thank you, John Pertwee. Eyes and Teeth is written, produced and hosted by Steve Hewlett. Vocals by Lola, Larissa and Nina Hewlett. Additional vocals by Rich T. The Eyes and Teeth music and jingles are produced and performed by Water Rat, Kevin Dean. Join me on the next edition of Eyes and Teeth, the final edition of Season 8, when I talk to personality and funny man and hairy biker about his early days in television behind the scenes. The final show is talking to the wonderful Dave Myers.